call the House Education Finance Committee to order. And we do have a quorum, so we can go ahead and proceed with our business today. First, we need to move adoption of the minutes, but we need to move a corrected version of the minutes from January 15th. One of our witnesses who presented testimony was inadvertently left off the list, so we do have a corrected version in your folders. Representative Erickson, would you be willing to offer a motion to move those corrected minutes from January 15th?
Madam Chair, I move approval of the corrected or amended minutes from January 15th.
Thank you, Representative Erickson. Any discussion? All right, seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? All right, they are approved. And let's see, Representative Seltzer, would you like to move adoption of the minutes for January 20th meeting?
Madam Chair, I move adoption of the minutes for the January 20th meeting.
Thank you very much, Representative Seltzer. Any discussion? All right, seeing none, all approved, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? All right, they are approved as well. Thank you very much. And we have a very extensive and exciting list of people here to present testimony today. So we'll go ahead and get started. The focus of today's hearing is on early childhood education in programs in Minnesota, and specifically those with some genesis and funding through the education finance budget. So we're going to start off with just a very brief presentation on what those programs are. By our House Research and Fiscal staff, Mr. Strom and Ms. Johnson. And then after that, we will hear from the Director of the Office of Early Learning, Mr. Carter. So with that, either Mr. Strom or Ms. Johnson, if you'd like to proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Committee members, Ms. Johnson and I are going to talk briefly about four programs today. The first two I'll talk about, which are ECFE and school readiness funding. There's two printouts in your packet that are district-by-district printouts. If you look first at the one that says estimated ECFE revenue by program allowance equals $134, that's the one I'll work off first. ECFE revenue is a mix of aid and levy. The legislature sets both the levy amount for the program and the formula allowance. It's what's referred to as an equalized aid and levy. So the aid share depends on the district's property tax wealth. The more property tax base the district has, the smaller its aid amount. The program had an allowance of $120 per measured population. And if you see the second column there of the printout shows adjusted ECFE population. The population that's used is the number of 0 to 4-year-olds in the district. You can see statewide that totals 368,000 students. And then there's a minimum built into the formula. So any district with fewer than 150 children of that age are given the minimum of 150 as their population count. The revenue then is simply the program allowance, which is currently $134.11 times that adjusted population. So in the middle column there, the revenue column, you can see ECFE revenue totals about $49 million for fiscal year 16. And then the levy is set as a uniform rate across all the districts in the state that raises about $22 million. And you can see there the levy share, and then the aid is simply the difference. So Madam Chair, very quickly, that's the revenue formula for the ECFE program. That's the largest program of the early childhood programs that's funded by the state.
And Mr. Strom, just a quick question. In a very few of the districts, there is a zero listed or levy, or in some cases, revenue. Could you explain that?
Madam Chair, we have a couple of different districts in the state, including Pine Point, that has no tax base. And a few of these programs are not available to a district unless they have a tax base. I should double check on Pine Point to make sure that this is accurate. I believe Pine Point, for that reason, does not have an ECFE program. I'll double check on that. And then a couple of things at the bottom of the first page, the state academies don't offer an early childhood program, and they show up on the printout. But otherwise, almost all of Minnesota's school districts participate in the program. There's just a very few that don't. And on the aid share, the number of zeros on the aid side, there's a number of programs where the levy is sufficient to provide the full amount of program revenue. So that's why you'll see zeros on the aid side.
Very well. Thank you. Please go ahead with your next chair.
Madam Chair, committee members, the next program I'd like to talk briefly about is the School Readiness Program. School Readiness is provided entirely in state aid for school districts in Minnesota, and there's two parts to the formula. The way the formula works, the legislature sets a dollar amount, and currently that dollar amount is set in statute at about $12 million per year, and then that's divided evenly into two aid formulas. Half of that money is based simply on the number of four-year-olds in the district, and the other half is based on the free and reduced lunch concentration in that district. The number of the number of free and reduced lunch eligible students in the entire district. So if you look at the printout, the second column in is the age four population. The best guess is there's 74,980 four-year-olds in the state of Minnesota. That's what the first half of the formula is determined on, and it's simply each district's percent of the total population that generates their revenue. So, for example, the very first district, there are 92 four-year-olds in the Aiken School District. 74,000ths of the revenue is the share that's Aiken's. Minneapolis has 5,318 four-year-olds. Their share is simply that percentage when put over 74,980. So half of the money is distributed in that third to last column. Half the money is distributed this way on a per pupil basis, age four-year-old pupil basis. And then the second half is distributed on the portion of the state's free and reduced lunch count that's in each district. And so you can see, for example, Aiken has 548 out of the 300,887 free and reduced lunch children, and so their revenue is that ratio times the $6 million that's in that part of the program. And then the last column is simply the total school readiness aid, estimated school readiness aid for fiscal year 16. We'll have a little better data in the next couple of weeks, so the aid amounts may change a little bit, but relatively speaking, there's not going to be big changes from year to year. One final point, the school readiness aid was increased from about 10 to about $12 million this last year. And the ECFE revenue was increased from $120 to $134 for the number of participants.
Thank you. Representative Quam, you had a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I was wondering if at any point the department looks at the free and reduced in the elementary level proportionality and the senior level, because sometimes there will be an influx of younger families in, and that would, you know, you might have a sort of a bifurcated distribution. And do they ever look at the, ECFE, that type of thing?
Mr. Strong.
Madam Chair, Representative Quam, that's a very good question. For simplicity's sake, the formula simply uses the total for the districts. The goal really is to try and match that population that's in the school readiness program. Data that the department has prepared for us in the past has shown higher participation rates at the elementary level than the secondary level. I think this is for two reasons. One, each subsequent grade cohort gets slightly poorer than the one prior to it, has been the long history in Minnesota and nationally. And secondly, there tends to be a fall off on the participation and the willingness to fill out the forms at the secondary level as well. So those two reasons contribute to a different distribution of free and reduced lunch by grade. The way the department counts that data is by site. I'm not sure on their general counts if we can find that by grade, but I think we could. So Ms. Johnson and I would be happy to look into that and give you some relative numbers for each of the different grade groups.
Thank you. All right, Ms. Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to speak briefly to two other early childhood education provisions that are primarily funded. The first is Head Start, and this is primarily a federally funded program. In the past years, it's been funded to approximately $100 million annually, and Minnesota started appropriating money to supplement that starting in 1989. So I have two handouts that you should have in front of you. One is a landscaped sheet that's titled SFY 2015 Minnesota Head Start Allocations, and I'll speak from that to start out with. The list of agencies you see here, the money for Head Start does not go directly to school districts. Instead, it goes to grantees or community action typically community action programs, and you'll see on this chart there's a list of community action organizations, and if you take a look at the other document that's also attached that's in portrait format, it gives the individual sites within each of these areas. So it gives you a better sense of where these are located geographically throughout the state. Excuse me. The next column just shows the participation rate of the different students in the, there's two components, one for children ages 0 to 2 in early Head Start, and then those for the traditional 3 to 4-year-old program. And you can see about 1,500 early Head Start were participating this year, and about 10,000 in the traditional Head Start. The next section shows the federal funding, and that combined is about $98 million for FY15. The TNTA that's at the top there, the federal funding also includes training and technical assistance, so that's what that refers to. The next column shows then the allocation of the state's portion of the Head Start funding of $20.1 million, and that has been a constant number over the last several years. The last two columns then just show the federal per child rate. You can see the early Head Start is significantly more costly on a per child basis than the regular Head Start. And I did do a quick analysis, and the state allocation on a per child basis is about $1,700 per student. And then just very briefly, I know that the kind of the main event today is talking about the early learning scholarships. Just wanted to say briefly that the 2000 legislature significantly scaled up the program and codified the current program for early learning scholarships. In FY13, there was $2 million, and then starting in FY14, it went to $23 million, and then currently for FY15, we're at $27.65 million. So I know that we'll probably have representatives from the department to speak more to that.
Right. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Johnson, I'm looking at the first handout on Head Start allocations. Would you re-explain the federal per child rate? I'm looking at these amounts in both columns, mm-hmm. and am wondering if that is indeed per child, and what, if you can answer this, does that cover in the Head Start program? Is that for salaries and all the amenities that go along with the Head Start program, or would you just clarify that, please?
Sure. Madam Chair? Yes, Representative Erickson. Yes, I did take a look. It was in spreadsheet format, and I was able to confirm that the way that calculation is made is by taking the, like, for example, for Anoka County cap, the $622,000 divided by the 60. And so that is the all-inclusive amount that includes all of the training and technical assistance salaries, the whole shebang. So
thank you.
Thank you. All right. Other questions? All right. Thank you very much. And again, if members have any, Representative Kwan.
Thank you. I was curious as to why the different provider groups are not more regionally associated, because I'm seeing the same cities being underneath as many as three different provider groups, and wouldn't that foster a little bit of inefficiency?
Ms. Johnson.
Madam Chair, Representative Klum, I don't know if I could speak to that. I could get more information for you on that, but I don't have anything right at my fingertips.
Thank you.
And Representative Klum, we will have, I think, someone from Head Start who will be testifying today, so perhaps there'll be a question they could address. So, all right. With that, I think we will now turn to our first testifiers, and I'm very pleased to have Mr. Melvin Carter, the Director of the Office of Early Learning, here with us today. And let's see, I'm not going to give you a tight time frame, but if you could maybe, let's say, about 10 minutes make your presentation. I want to allow for some member questions, and then we've got, a pretty long list of testifiers today, so we're going to be having to race the clock here to get all of this material in. So with that, please go ahead and introduce yourself, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Good afternoon, and we just really thank you for your interest and your leadership on early childhood issues. My name is Melvin Carter. I direct the state's Office of Early Learning. I'm joined with Lisa Barnage, who manages our state scholarship program. With your permission, I'll give just a couple of slides on what the Office of Early Learning is and how we're kind of working across agencies to serve young children well, and then pass the microphone here to Lisa, who will talk and give more specific scholarship program-level data on scholarship. As you know, the Minnesota Office of Early Learning is a partnership, an interagency office of our state's Departments of Education, Health, and Human Services. You can see our mission and our vision on the board. Our mission really focuses on partnering with families and communities, knowing those are the people who are face-to-face with children all day, every day. Really focuses on aligning the human and financial supports across agencies, because we know there's work to do there. Really focuses on the notion, the understanding, I'll talk more about in a second, that we're focused far beyond just what's traditional thought as learning to child development, which is much more all-inclusive, and also from prenatal through grade three, which is critical because we know that whole phase is really critical for a child's life. Ultimately, though, our charge is at the bottom, is to work together to do more for Minnesota children working together than we can working separately, and that's what we're working to do. This next slide really shows kind of how we think about our interagency work, understanding that the goal of getting children off to a strong academic start is certainly not unrelated from the goals of making sure that they are in safe, stable, and secure families, to make sure that they've got a healthy start. All of that works well together. And to whatever extent that we can make sure that children are off to a healthy start, that'll help us make sure they're kindergarten ready with all of the academic skills that we want them to have as well. In fact, our definition of kindergarten ready is not purely academic. Our definition of kindergarten ready means the extent to which children come into school ready to learn and ready to succeed in school. And most of that is actually about socio-emotional health and those and well-being. I'll say right here, as my iPad just locked up on me with my comments. So what we're working to do is build that collective impact model so that the folks who are working mostly on directly on learning, the folks who are working directly on keeping families stable, the folks who are working directly on health are all working together in a collaborative way. We're working to expand our state's Help Me Grow system, which is working really well right now to connect children who qualify for early special education services to relevant resources which can help. It's doing really well. Our challenge that we're looking at is trying to figure out how to expand that so we can connect a broader set of children to a broader set of resources. That's really critical. And although this isn't my first time visiting with you today or this session, we spent a lot of time in this committee last year talking about the need to simplify and streamline some of the processes through which families access resources in Minnesota. And so we're also having conversations about the possibilities of pursuing a common application across agencies so that families can access services more easily. So with that, I'll pass it to Lisa to talk. But essentially, the bottom line of what I have to say is we know that investing in young children is very, very critical. We have a lot of evidence that that's the case. And maximizing our returns on these investments, we know, require us to make sure that the resources that we administer across agencies are not just a really long laundry list with a lot of resources behind them, but they're really working together as one balanced investment portfolio. So with that said, I'll ask Lisa to give us more specific information on the early learning scholarships as a very critical component of that broader investment portfolio.
Madam Chair?
Welcome.
Thank you. My name is Lisa Barnage, and I do work at the Department of Education, and I oversee the Early Learning Scholarship Program. So I will try in a quick manner to try to explain to you the Early Learning Scholarship Program, knowing that some of you are new to this committee this year, and trying not to give too much into the details for those of you who know this program pretty well. The goals of the Early Learning Scholarship Program, partly stated in statute mostly, is that it's a financial way to help families access high-quality early education and care programs for especially those children with the highest needs, in an effort to ensure that we are improving school readiness for all Minnesota's youngest children. When we at the department began to roll this program out, we also wanted to make sure that we were creating a program that could expand and help sustain a comprehensive early learning system, which is in the state, as many of you know, a very complex system, and wanting to make sure that we were being flexible and that we could grow, as you have noted, as House Research has noted, has happened quite extensively over the last 3 years. Currently, as House Research noted, we are at $27.65 million in early learning scholarship per year. Next year, it actually goes up to 27.8. So we note that that is a great effort on Minnesota's behalf to improving outcomes for young children. Additionally, though, that this funding actually still only serves approximately 10% of the eligible 3- and 4-year-olds in the state. And with that in mind, and trying to make sure we were building a program that could be sustainable, we wanted to make sure that we did distribute the funds in a manner that allowed for that expansion, as well as creating a critical mass in communities to create some efficiency in how we administer the program and to create some supply in the programs available to program to children and families. The distribution plan that we used was based mostly on need in communities. So we looked at poverty concentration, modeling after the poverty concentration for compensatory revenue. To Representative Quam's question, we do use actually in our formula for scholarships just kindergarten free and reduced lunch, but it is modeled after compensatory revenue. We also looked at priority schools. We all know that priority schools are our waiver schools that have high needs to improve outcomes for children. And we wanted to make sure that we were sustaining communities that had received the initial early childhood scholarships with the $2 million. As you know, the current statute does require that children, once receiving a scholarship, continue to receive a scholarship. So we need to sustain that for those children. There are two different methods for which scholarships are made available to families. Families can access scholarships by applying through a regional administrator. We have 13 regional administrators across each of the economic development regions. When a family chooses to apply for a scholarship in that manner, they do receive a scholarship dependent upon the parent-aware rated program or the rating of their program they choose. So this shows that if they choose a program that's three or four star rated, they get a $5,000 scholarship. 1 and 2 is a $3,000 scholarship, and if they choose a program that is initially in parent aware seeking a rating, they can still receive a scholarship for up to $3,000 to use at that program. Another way that children can access early learning scholarships throughout the state is to choose a program that has a 4-star rating with a Pathway 2 allocation. Then the program can help them apply for that scholarship and use it at that program. This helped to create our ability to expand quickly throughout the region or throughout the state and allow for some building of infrastructure for places where programs that had high waiting lists. Just a quick note that the difference, pretty much as I kind of noted for Pathway 1s, is families first apply and then they can choose a program. And then for Pathway 2s, it's that a parent chooses a program. They have a program in mind that has a 4-star rating with a Pathway 2 allocation, and then they can apply for the scholarship. This is a quick map of where scholarships, Pathway 1 scholarships, are available throughout the state. If you can see, there's some hashed marks, and those are the red counties on this list. Those are the counties we were able to expand to last year due to the additional $4 million that the legislature appropriated at the end of fiscal year 14 for fiscal year 15. So we were able to add a county to every economic region with that additional money. We have a slightly different map for Pathway 1s. Again, this difference was also allowed us in the first couple of years to expand to areas of the state which may not have had parent aware at the time, parent aware rolling out. It is this year across the state, but originally it was not throughout the state. Quickly, this is some information regarding the end of fiscal year 2014 data on the early learning scholarships. It might be easier for you to look on your pages, but I want to note that the first three columns, we do an estimate of how many scholarships would be available based on that $5,000 mark. I could have given you just the last column, which says how many scholarships were given, but that may be not a good mark for you to look at if you didn't know about how much money was available as well. So last fiscal year, we were able to give out 5,871 early learning scholarships across the state. And these are the breakouts by region. That information we also been able to collect by a couple different qualifiers. So for Pathway 1s, we can see that last year families chose to take their Pathway 1 scholarships to this varying degree of different types of programs, all parent-aware, participating in parent-aware. But we do have a breakout of 19% going to Head Start, 19% going to school-based programs. 3% is to a community-based preschool program. That would be it would be a licensed child care program. 49% going to child care centers, and 10% going to family child care providers. Still on Pathway 1 information, this is the breakout by age. About 40% were 3-year-olds and 42% were 4-year-olds, and that leaves 18% for those under the age of 3. And then
Excuse me, Ms. Barnett, just to clarify on that, so those under the age of 3 must have a sibling that's 3 or 4 in a program with a scholarship, correct?
There is actually two ways that a child under 3 can receive a scholarship, and that is correct. One way is that they are a sibling of an older child with a scholarship. The other way is a teen parent may apply and receive a scholarship for a child 0-5.
Thank you.
But yes, that is correct. And then lastly for Pathway 1s, just a quick breakout of what type of parent-aware star rating that children use. Very pleased to see that this scholarship has the scholarships have been able to move children or assist children in accessing 4-star rated parent-aware rated programs. 80% of the scholarships are going to 4-star parent-aware rated programs. Additionally, though, we are seeing, especially I think this number might grow this year as parent-aware rolls out to all counties, but also it is incentivizing programs by allowing them to be used in those programs with signed participation agreements, those seeking a rating. So that is the breakout by star rating. We do have a little bit of the data by Pathway 2 as well. The scholarships for Pathway 2 last year, 15% were used in Head Start, and I'm going to say 20% were used in a child care setting, and 65% were used in school-based programs. And then the age of the children by Pathway 2 also varies. 67% were actually the age of 4, and 28, 3. This is preliminary data about where we are standing at today for fiscal year 2015. When the children from fiscal year 14, if you see a lot of them aged out, that makes more scholarships available for new children, and then the additional $4 million. So as of December 31st, we know that approximately 4,754 children are currently on an early learning scholarship. We are still receiving applications, and I do know that most regions in the state do have a wait list for the early learning scholarships. As again, as House Research had noted, this program is a fairly new program, and it has ramped up very quickly. We do continue to look at improvements about how we administer this program and looking for efficiencies. Some things that we have been able to implement are regional administrator quarterly meetings. We bring in all 13 regional administrators quarterly to talk to them about implementation challenges, work through some problems, and as well as disseminate more information to them around new policies and how we can improve our process with the program. We also have, we have begun to activate an administrative system, which will help the state be able to monitor the program and administer and streamline the processes that we do have. In that process, we have recently just hired a system manager for the Early Learning Scholarship Administrative System. And we continue to develop and refine policies around the program. And things that we're looking forward to this year is continued outreach and recruitment in regions, especially in greater Minnesota, where Parent Aware is also new, and the scholarship program is a newer program for them. As well as we are with the Pathway 2 application, we're looking forward to improving our program application process this year, moving that up earlier in the year so programs have some planning time. The last 2 years have been difficult just due to timing of when legislative session ends, but now we have it in our base and we can plan a little bit better this year for programs and families. And providing revising that application so it's more friendly to all program types. We're also working with programs to streamline the family application process with their own program application processes. And that's it. Sorry, hopefully I didn't go too fast for you.
You did very well with a tight time frame. Thank you, Ms. Varnage. I do have Representative Crescia has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just quickly on as I go back to slide 18, and I'm just curious, do you have an estimation of what your unmet needs are for the scholarships right now?
Ms. Barnett.
Madam Chair, Representative, the easiest maybe way I could answer it for you today is we do know that we're serving the scholarship of current capped appropriation serves approximately 10% of eligible 3- and 4-year-olds. So we would know that then there are 90% more. So we said we're approximating a $5,000 scholarships per year at the current dollar amount. $5,000 scholarships, tongue twister there, with the current dollar amount. So, and we approximate with the free and reduced lunch count about 25,000 children per age cohort that are free and reduced lunch eligible. So that would be 50,000 for 3- and 4-year-olds.
Representative
Crescia. And thank you, Ms. Barnage. That's helpful, but what I'm looking for is what's the waiting list look like? I mean, obviously we can draw how big the market is, but what I want to really know is who's actually applying and who's not getting on.
Madam Chair, Representative, we are collecting some of that information from the regional administrator. I don't have it on hand, so we can get back to you for that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, I have several members on the list. Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A comment, and then I'm going to see if I can remember the question that I had in my head a minute ago, and I'm not sure I'll be able to, but I just wanted to thank both of the testifiers for the attention that I'm hearing to simplifying, streamlining the administration. I don't have Mr. Carter's articulateness, but the unified application so that folks can apply for one program and use that across multiple programs is going to make these families' lives a lot easier when you're able to get to that. And that, of course, means it's better for the little kids that the program serves, as well as things like the timeline issues that you raised, ma'am. I guess maybe you're moving from infant to toddler in terms of age, and you're getting your legs under you. That's all good. That's all good, and I appreciate that. And, Madam Chair, I can't remember the question for the life of me, so next time you're in front of the committee. But thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Madam
Chair. Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Dabney, it gets worse.
what does?
Never mind.
Did you speak?
Representative Hertas.
My question is with regard to Pathway 1 and Pathway 2. I see in the presentation that the state is divided into 11 regions, and then it further identifies the counties that it serves. Was it an omission, or is it intentional, or is there simply not any programs that exist either for Pathway 1 or Pathway 2 for what appears to be 13 counties in the state are omitted?
Ms. Barnage.
Madam Chair, Representative. So I would have to overlay both maps to identify which counties have neither Pathway 1 or Pathway 2, but under Pathway 1, that is correct. 13 counties currently do not. Actually, Representative, I actually believe it. We are in 57 of 80 seven, 54 of 87 counties with Pathway 1 scholarships. That's partly due so that we can ensure that in the counties we are in, we have enough scholarships available for making an efficient administrative program, as well as creating supply demand for programs to respond to.
Representative Hurtas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm sharing Representative Davini's problem. I was thinking there were 67 counties, but that's legislative districts. There are more counties, so thank you.
All right. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And during the response to Representative Kreisha's question and query about the sizing of it, I noticed your response was just in the 5,000, but your presentation had 5, 4, and 3,000. Do you have a data on distribution between those three, and then a projected with the ones that aren't covered, where they would fall in, so we'd have a better idea of what the size is instead of just going by five?
Ms. Barnett?
Madam Chair, Representative, I could look into that. As you were talking, I was thinking mathematically how I could try to find an answer for that question. I don't have it at the moment. We do make an estimation of 5,000 because, one, we don't know what parents will choose, and two, parents may choose to make different choices halfway through the year. So we do not know what all the different changes they might make that could still bump them up to that $5,000 amount.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If the committee could receive a more complete view of projected size.
Thank you. Yes, Ms. Barnage, if that would be something you could put together and send to the committee, we'll make sure that it's distributed to the membership.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Seltzer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this, maybe I didn't quite understand the questions that were being asked, and so maybe I'm being repetitive here, but we've got the scholarship program, which is doing really well. We have Head Start, we've got ECFB, and we've got kindergarten readiness in addition to private situations out there for preschoolers. When we look at children in poverty, let's just take four-year-olds. Do we have any idea, and maybe this is for Mr. Carter, do we have any idea of the number of four-year-olds in poverty not receiving any of these services?
Mr. Carter.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative. That's a difficult number to come up with, and mostly because it's hard to deduplicate the lists of children who are serving, who are receiving CCAP versus kind of other types of resources. And so that's actually a very difficult question to come up with. Frankly, it's because of a good thing. We want families to be able to access multiple channels of resources, but that also just makes it more and more difficult to create one non-duplicative list.
Representative Seltzer.
Certainly. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Carter. We do know that we're making progress because over 70% of students are coming to kindergarten now ready, yes, according to our testing. So that certainly is a dramatic improvement, and I guess maybe we could watch that number. And I just had one other question, Madam Chair. This is a big question, so any little part of it that you could answer would be great. I really appreciated what you said about different departments, you know, working together. Health and Human Services, of course, comes to mind with their programs for young children and families, and then, of course, the work that we're doing in early childhood. Could you just talk a little bit about ways that HHS and your department are working together to serve kids' needs and also to avoid duplication?
Absolutely, and thank you,
Mr.
so
Carter.
Much. Oh, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Madam Chair, Representative, I apologize. Thank you so much. I appreciate the reminder, you know, and that conversation we were having about working as a portfolio. I've got two young daughters myself, and my question with them is never what's the one thing I can do to ensure their future. My question about them is what's everything that I can do to ensure their future. And so that's, I think, the approach that we have in Minnesota, that we are really focused on making sure, going out of our way to make sure that young children in Minnesota are off to a great start. That's something that folks have recognized. Actually, I saw a letter recently sent by a coalition of about a couple of hundred, I think 250 business leaders around the country, who wrote a letter to the president and to Congress, and saying that as business leaders, we rarely have the amount of evidence that we have to invest in young children, to make, as far as their business investments are concerned. I'm beginning to share the problem that's going around today because I'm trying to get back to the question that was asked.
You're too young for that.
I know. How are we working? I'm sorry.
Yeah.
That Help Me Grow system that I told you about is really critical. We are working really to build out a single door interface so that families can serve, can connect to resources across agencies most effectively. We are working as we administer resources in MDE, we administer resources in Department of Human Services, for example, to work together to make sure that the professional development that we provide is consistent, to make sure that the standards for early learning that we provide through Parent Aware quality standards, through our early childhood indicators of progress across kind of these different kind of funding streams are consistent. We're working together. We worked together to make sure that we've all got one agreed upon definition of kindergarten readiness, which I shared with you, which is far beyond just kind of literacy and math type skills and colors. It really focuses on children's socio-emotional preparedness to succeed in an academic environment. So those are a couple of the ways. I'm really excited for the conversation that Representative Dabney mentioned about trying to figure out, are there ways, as someone who formerly was in elected office myself, I sometimes take the liberty of these highly oversimplified rhetorical statements, and the statement has been, that all of the law schools in the country have come up with one application to share, and so let's try to do it ourselves. And so I think that can be something that's really important as well for families.
Thank you, Mr. Carter. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Seltzer. All right, members, I've got a pretty lengthy list left yet of about five or six members on the list, and we're getting close to 1:30, which means we've got an hour to get through about 11 or 12 other testifiers. So I would ask members to try to be brief in your questioning, and because I do want to allow as many questions as possible. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Realizing this is a new program, a relatively new, any thoughts or methods or ways to evaluate the program's success in making kids, the young early learning kids, more school ready as they go through this program?
Ms. Varnage?
Madam Chair, I'll try to be short and brief. I would let you know that the statute does require that we do an evaluation of the program. We have hired an independent contractor. Our first report is due to the legislature next January, so I could provide you some more information then. But we are in the process of evaluating it. Thank you.
Thank you. Let's see. Representative Bennett.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for our presenters for coming today. I wrote my question down, and I take Representative Dabney's cue here. But what percent of per-child costs that you've listed on these goes to the administration of the program versus, actual child in the classroom type? Do you have information on that?
Ms. Barnett.
Madam Chair, Representative, I believe what you might be looking at is about Head Start, but I can tell you that with the Early Learning Scholarship Program, we do provide an 8% administrative cost to our regional administrators through the grant process. I do not know at the programmatic level how much goes directly and across the three different types of programs. It would probably vary. But we do, if that is appropriate, answer your question.
That's
the administrators
give
8%.
Yeah, thanks.
Okay, thank you. Representative Ansels.
Thank you, Madam Chair. with regard to the scholarship program and its newness and almost experimental nature of it, I'd like to know what's being done to establish the infrastructure for these services to kids on a statewide basis, recognizing that there are gaps and there are differences throughout the state, but this is expected to be a statewide program. And what are the numbers for 14? Breaking out the 7-county metropolitan area from the 80 counties in greater Minnesota. The ratio of scholarships in the metro versus scholarships in the 80 other counties of greater Minnesota.
Either Mr. Carter or Ms. Barnage, whoever wants to take that one.
I'll take it. Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative. It's well noted, this absolutely is intended to be and is being administered as a statewide program. It's relevant as we look at the map and the list of counties and the conversation about the 54 counties listed on the board and the 87 counties we know that we have in Minnesota. This is actually part of the balance that we've had in terms of setting what the average scholarship amount is or the maximum scholarship amount is balancing that notion of really trying to provide resources, significant resources for families who need them, but also trying to spread them across the state in a statewide program. We administered it, as we talked about earlier, based on poverty data for child poverty in the state. The basic, I think, answer that you're looking for is the number of resources that are being administered in the greater metropolitan area, which is about 50-50. I believe it's actually 51-49 metropolitan area, 7-county metro versus greater Minnesota as well.
Representative Mantels.
I'll pass.
Thank you. Representative Wills.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had two questions. Hopefully they'll be quick. First question, I don't know if it'll be for Mr. Carter or I forgot your last name
Barnage,
already. I'm sorry.
Ms. Barnage.
And the question has to do with the difference between the Pathway 1 and Pathway 2. Just looking at the charts and the breakdown of which different programs they're going to. And I noticed, this is slides 13 and slide 16, that for Pathway 1, there's five different types of programs that it's going to. And for Pathway 2, I noticed that it's only four, and it doesn't include the licensed family child care providers. And I was just wondering why that is, if the licensed child care providers aren't seeking the Pathway 2 scholarships, or you know why it broke down that way. So that's my first question.
Ms. Barnage.
Madam Chair, Representative. Actually, the main reason is that to be a Pathway 2 program, you do need to be a four-star rated program. And when scholarships originally rolled out in 2014, they were not statewide. ParentAware was not yet statewide, so there wasn't four-star rated programs for family child care across the state yet. So we still do have a smaller proportion of family child care providers that do meet that four-star rating requirement. The other would be that what we're trying to work on is making that pathway more accessible to all program types. I do believe that they did not apply. We did not receive applications from them to be Pathway 2 programs.
Representative Wills.
Oh, okay, thank you. I appreciate the explanation. And my guess would be maybe it's just too early for them and that they'll be requesting them as they get up to the four-star rated for those who pursue Parent Aware. And I'll probably have questions on the Parent Aware when we get to that point. But that spawned one more question. Is it true that Head Start programs are automatically four-star rated for Parent Aware?
Ms. Barnes.
Madam Chair, Representative, I'll try to quickly answer it. Of course, the Department of Human Services does administer Parent Aware. But for school-based programs, accredited child care programs, and Head Start programs who do have outside requirements, federal, state, and other organizing bodies of quality that they must meet, they can enter Parent Aware through an accelerated rating process, which does acknowledge the other requirements for which they must meet, and it requires a few other indicators, which is they must use an approved assessment and must have training and approved curriculum and have training on both assessment and curriculum. So it's not an automatic rating, but it is an accelerated pathway for them.
Representative Wills?
Sorry, I don't mean to be taking up all the time, but
very quickly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a thought on that it might be nice to be able to have that accelerated process for any program that wanted to participate and make it easier as you've been talking about streamlining the process. So just a thought there. And then my other question, let's head on another page here, was on the Pathway to Scholarships. Does the funding that the programs get, does it have to be used specifically for scholarships to increase the number of children being served, or can it be used for program enhancements? Or, like, how does that work?
Ms. Barnage.
Representative, Madam Chair. The statute does allow for providers to use the funds to expand the number of children they provide or provide enhanced services to children, improving the quality of the services that children are receiving.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Ms. Barnage. That helps clear that up for me. I guess I'm just concerned that I want to make sure that these scholarships are getting out to as many students and children as possible, so that might be something we'll have to look at. So thank you.
Thank you. All right, and Representative Mullery, I'm going to let you have the last question before we move to our next panel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've got three quick ones. Do you know the number of total of CCAP, and I would guess BSF would, if they're in either of those, I would guess they'd qualify for scholarships. Do you know the total in the state of those?
Ms. Barnage?
Madam Chair, Representative Mullery, we do not know, and I'm not sure that anyone from DHS here is available to tell us the number of children that are currently on CCAP, our basic sliding fee.
Okay, next question is, do you know the number of districts? Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry.
Madam Chair,
go ahead.
Do you know the number of districts doing their own without any state help, just on their property tax? I know I was met with, for instance, Aiken superintendent. They've got a really active board interested in education. They're going to pay for their own complete. I'm just wondering, is there a lot of that going starting around the state, or do you have any idea what's happening on that?
Ms. Varnish.
Madam Chair, Representative Mullery, the department does not actually collect that type of data from school districts. We do know that in the metro area, we're very aware of many school districts offering programs on top of school readiness programs, or enhancing their school readiness funds to provide the program to more families. And we also are seeing it in greater Minnesota as well, but we don't collect the data specifically. It's not a required reporting requirement for them.
Thank you. Madam Chair, one other question.
Representative Mullery.
I hope you do kind of get some data on that. But do you know anything? I've been approached by quite a few African-American daycare providers who have all the national certifications, everything, and they say they've had an awful time. And there's a lot of concern that Parent Aware isn't bringing in their culture. They can't get the rated. Are you looking into that at all or anything?
Mr. Carter.
Madam Chair, Representative Mullery, thank you. Parent Aware is, of course, administered by the Department of Human Services. I don't have that exact information.
But you kind of are three departments.
Indeed. What I was going to say is I don't have the exact exact data in front of me, but that's certainly something that we've been tracking. It's something you and I have discussed, of course. And I have seen that in the past, I think, year and a half or so, I think staff has done a really good job really focusing on getting outreach. And as you hear about Parent Aware, perhaps it'll be in the information today. If not, I can get that followed up to you, that we have made a pretty strong push to engage Family Child Care and Parent Aware, to engage unaccredited providers in Parent Aware, and to really engage deeply in communities of color around the state. And that has come with some really strong kind of results. And so I'll look forward to getting that. We have some exact data to break down as far as culture and languages for the providers who are rated, and so I can get that to you as a follow-up.
Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Carter and Ms. Barnett. You did a terrific job. We very much appreciate you coming to the committee and for your information. All right. So next I'm going to ask Erica Moss, Executive Director of Parent Aware for School Readiness, to come down. And just, you know, overall, members, we're going to be really tight on time with the long list of people who would like to testify. So I would ask if you're when we get to questions, if you could be very brief, and we can always try to schedule another day. But for folks who specifically plan to be here, I'm just hoping we can give them all an opportunity to at least say a little something to the committee. So with that, welcome, Ms. Moss. Please introduce yourself for the record and present your testimony.
Thanks, Madam Chair and members. My name is Erica Moss. I'm the Executive Director of Parent Aware for School Readiness, which is a independent nonprofit organization, business and community leaders on our board, focused on improving kindergarten readiness in Minnesota. And for those of you who have been around for a while, we are the successor organization to the Minnesota Early Learning Foundation, which operated for 5 years and invested about $20 million in private investment in finding cost-effective ways for preparing all Minnesota kids for kindergarten. And actually, it was the recommendations of that Early Learning Foundation, which were sort of based on work of Art Rolnick at the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis, that kind of set the foundation for the scholarship program and the expansion of the Parent Aware ratings statewide, which has been happening in large part fueled by federal investment from a Race to the Top grant. You just heard about scholarships. I can talk a little bit about what's happening with Parent Aware, and then maybe talk more broadly about the two programs and the implementation of the programs and how that syncs with what the Minnesota Early Learning Foundation found during its research. So Parent Aware ratings as of January 1st, 2015 are now available to child care providers across the state, in all counties of the state. The rollout was staged, so there were some counties that came online later and some that came online earlier, but it is now a statewide program. I don't have up-to-the-minute information. I should also explain that we don't operate the rating system. It is a state-run program operated out of the Minnesota Department of Human Services. We support the program. We fill gaps to ensure effective implementation to the program with a particular focus on helping put parents in touch with information about childcare and their options. So based on my understanding, there are about 2,000 programs participating across the state. Programs from a variety of programs are eligible to participate. So school-based pre-kindergarten programs, Head Start and early Head Start programs, IDEA programs in school districts, accredited child care centers, accredited family child care centers, and then, of course, non-accredited child care centers and family child care centers. So there's a wide array of programs that are eligible to participate in the rating system. Some from each of those groups are participating, as you might expect, in areas that where the ratings came online earlier in 2012. There are more voluntarily rated programs than there are in other areas. And then Ms. Barnage mentioned the what's known as the accelerated pathway to rating. That has been available statewide since 2012. So a large portion of the supply is still supply that came through that accelerated pathway. But the growth now in the program is coming in large part from licensed family child care providers. I believe during 2014 that participation among that group grew by about 80%. To Representative Mulery's question, there has been a great emphasis and focus on recruiting providers who are serving low-income children of color. Barb Yates isn't here today, but Think Small recently reported that they are that about 80% of the participating providers in Hennepin and Ramsey counties are providers of color, and we have in a recent analysis by the Department of Human Services looking statewide high participation among non-English speaking providers as well. So I'm sure there are lots more specific questions about the numbers related to Parent Aware. I won't go any deeper into that right now, but those can be made available to the committee. I want to also just start by just being really explicit about the fact that we're talking about early learning and we're talking about a whole bunch of different types of providers of early learning services. So this isn't, when we think about this and when Melf was working on this, there is a broad expanse of options available now in places where this happens. It happens in church basements. It happens in public schools. It happens in charter schools. It happens in family child care homes. It happens in child care centers. It happens in a wide variety of places. And this market-based approach that we're working on through Parent Aware and Scholarships seeks to create an even playing field for all of those different types of providers to serve kids, and tries to take policymakers and other people out of the position of picking winners and losers, and instead to empower parents to set the supply in their local community. So what you get in a particular place will reflect what parents want in that particular place, or the particular circumstances of a local community. So really trying to set an approach that that is flexible, and that local communities can kind of take and make their own. And we're seeing tremendous, just tremendous things are happening around the state. I think there are some really great success stories with Parent Aware. I think of the northeastern part of the state, where they've attracted, you know, recently about $500,000 of private investment, and where it's the local community organizations that are working with providers and helping to train them and helping to encourage their participation in Parent Aware. It's not a top-down kind of a thing. It's coming from that local community. Similar things are happening in the west central part of the state and in southern Minnesota, and it's not even necessarily state-funded organizations that are doing this. In a lot of instances, it's local community-based organizations or local community foundations. So we've been really encouraged to see local communities embracing the opportunity that's been offered by Parent Aware and Scholarships and figuring out how to make it work best for them. That's one of the most encouraging things, I think, about this suite of programs. Our mission is about getting more Minnesota children ready for kindergarten. Obviously, we have this history of supporting a market-based approach, as I said earlier, allowing parents to set the supply in their local neighborhood. So we have that position. We work on Parent Aware, and we also have, not surprisingly, ideas about scholarships. The Early Learning Foundation's $20 million investment was to pilot Parent Aware and also early learning scholarships. And we've been encouraged to see the state fund those scholarships and make those scholarships available to more than 5,000 kids around the state. That's been really positive, but we do have some concerns about the implementation of the scholarships, in particular ways that the scholarships have been made less portable and flexible for parents. And there have been some recent changes in statute there were last session to help streamline the administration. We absolutely understand that concern. We are not for excessive regulation or burdensome administration, but are concerned that that we could get to a point where scholarships are a lot more like state aid than they are like scholarships for families. And so we want to ensure that parents who get a scholarship know that they have a scholarship, understand the benefit for their family, that they have an opportunity to select among a range of options, and very importantly, that if that family's circumstances change and necessitates a change in program, maybe mid-year, that the money follow that child to the next program of that family's choosing. You can imagine a situation where a family is using a school district program and they leave that district and move to a new school district and are out of luck, don't have any opportunities to maintain the continuity in their child's early learning. So those things are really important to us and are things that we're paying attention to. In addition, we've been hearing a lot from our stakeholders and partners, and we have, you know, board members working on this in Greater Minnesota, and they're finding it difficult in some instances to get children the complete services that they need because those children are not allowed to split their scholarship among two providers. So in Greater Minnesota, it's much more common that a preschool program operates three mornings a week. And the family would really like to use that opportunity and combine it with some other opportunity to continue the high-quality early learning for their child. And that's not currently possible. And so we've been hearing a lot about that as a problem and a barrier to making scholarships successful in Greater Minnesota. Just back to my opening point about equal opportunities and a fair playing field. We really want to see, and I was pleased by Representative Will's question about the administration of Pathway 2 and the fact that there hasn't yet been a licensed family child care provider who successfully participated in that program. We have a consultant who works for us and does some grant writing for us sometimes, who writes grants for the federal government, very talented woman, and she is on the board of a child care organization that competed for Pathway 2 resources, and it took her 40 hours to do the work associated with that application. So I think there definitely is room to improve that process, and to Mr. Carter and Ms. Barnage alluded to this, to make it more easily accessible by all the different types of providers. There are obviously special considerations involved when you're talking about a woman-run small business, sole proprietor in most cases, with kids 10 to 12 hours a day. Just trying to figure out, and the same holds for the parent aware process, trying to figure out how to make these processes as streamlined as they possibly can be to meet the policy goals, but taking into consideration the burden that's being put on individuals. We, in terms of fairness, I guess the final thing that I would talk about is that current law will limit the ability of any parent aware participating provider to serve eligible children beginning in 2016. And as we just heard, many counties have only now in 2015 first had the opportunity to come on board with Parent Aware, to participate in the rating service, rating program, to work on their quality improvement, those kinds of things. It just doesn't seem quite fair to those providers in parts of the state where they haven't had the opportunity to already be limiting their opportunity to serve children with scholarships. And that's a particular concern as well for counties in greater Minnesota that have come online later. So those are some of the things that we're thinking about as we come into this legislative session, keeping an even playing field. We are also very interested in providing more scholarships for eligible children. As you heard, we're serving about 10% of the eligible population right now, those kids who we think would take advantage of a scholarship. And we need many, many more if we're going to ensure a world-class education for Minnesota's children. So we by our estimates, there are about 15,000 kids who are unserved. And, scholarships aren't the only way that we're looking at improving access to high quality. We're also recommending that the Child Care Assistance Program, which spends an estimated $230 million a year, be reformed to better meet kindergarten readiness goals so that we're making the best use of both existing resources and new resources as we seek to better serve children in the state. But again, even if that CCAP reform is enacted, we need many more scholarships to help the 15,000 kids that are currently without access. Our recommendations for the committee in 2015, equal opportunity to earn rewards for all eligible providers, make scholarships portable, flexible, and empowering for parents, and enact more early learning scholarships for low-income kids. If we can work with you to achieve these goals, we think we'll be well on our way to preparing more children for kindergarten and narrowing the achievement gap. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Moss. Representative Murphy, you've been patiently waiting. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to go back to Mr. Representative Kershaw's question, Mr. Carter. He said that it was very difficult to know who was being served or who was not, or how many underserved people or not served children there were. And with your market-based approach, can you use the 15,000 figure at the end? Do you have a county-by-county idea of the people that aren't served, or the children that aren't served, and their age groups?
Ms. Moss.
Madam Chair and Representative Murphy, we do have that information. Rob Grunwald from the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis has been doing modeling on scholarships and what it might look like over several years now. I know he's just updating his model based on new information about the kinds of programs that parents are picking, those kinds of things. But, yeah, we do know by county, the number of eligible kids, what kind of program they're being served in now, if they're being served, how many we expect would want to use a scholarship. All of that kind of underlies that 15,000 number, and I'd be happy to get you the detail.
Thank you.
Do you have an additional question, Representative Murphy? No. I'm sorry. Okay, thank you.
I'm just trying to find out how many there are.
Thank you. It's a very good question. All right. So I think what we'll do is move on to the rest of our testifiers. And thank you very much, Ms. Moss. I will ask all of you, I'll just start calling off names, if you can kind of come ready and come down towards the testifier table and be ready. And if you could all try to keep, and I apologize, but try to keep your remarks, I'm going to say, to about 3 minutes, so we can try to get through you all. We will be having another time in committee to be taking up this topic. And the topic of early childhood education is a big one, and it's just really hard to cover in, you know, an hour and a half in committee. So I apologize for how brief it will be for some of you, but we will have another day, I promise. So I have Gail Kelly, Executive Director of the Minnesota Head Start Association. And then behind her, Ms. Potter from the Robbinsdale Area School, so she would be ready next. All right. Welcome. Please go ahead and introduce yourself and present your testimony.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Gail Kelly. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Head Start Association, and I'm sorry if my glasses are a distraction. I actually reside in Duluth, so it's nice to come from the Northland. I appreciate a day that it isn't snowing, so thank you. For the benefit of members that are new, I'll give you a brief introduction to Head Start and Early Head Start. Head Start and Early Head Start are early childhood and family development programs. They were authorized by the federal government in 1965 and Early Head Start in 1996. And we are celebrating a 50-year anniversary, but the program that was piloted as a summer program 50 years ago doesn't look much like the program that is Head Start today. Head Start is an evidence-based intervention that applies state-of-the-art curricula, assessments, and learning approaches to help families get their young children ready for school. You'll often hear the word comprehensive discussed when talking about Head Start, and what that really means is that we provide a wide range of family engagement services, nutrition, health, education, and social services to meet the needs of individual children and families. And you'll see those evident if you visit any of our programs, which I welcome you to do, and whether it is a center-based program, a home-based program, or a partnership with a child care provider. We employ qualified teachers, we employ home visitors, and early childhood administrators, and are largely our costs are related to all the people that touch our children. Our ratios for Head Start are 17 to 1 in a center-based, 1 to 1 in a home-based, and an early Head Start, 1 to 4. So they're very low. Our services are targeted to the highest risk families, and those that are income eligible, and the eligibility is at 100% of poverty, which is the lowest that any federal program, social service program, it has. And we have to, because we're not fully funded, we have to prioritize our enrollment. So we use a different risk criteria to determine that. And it gives us a population that's largely reflective of the most at risk in Minnesota. It's 50% culturally diverse. Over 30% are English language learners. We have over 14% are children who are diagnosed with a disability, and 9% are homeless. So 33 programs serve all of 87 counties, and that we do serve in some service areas have more than one provider, and that's if there's a tribal program that's operating, because the federal government authorizes tribal programs to serve all their children, not just at 100% of poverty. The handout in your folder, which you'll find, I hope got in here, it was an independent analysis by a professor at the University of Tulsa, who we send all of our child assessment data on four-year-olds, a very large sample of four-year-olds. And we ask him to evaluate whether we're getting kids ready for school. And Dr. Hendricks reported for the last 2 years that we're getting about 90% of children ready for kindergarten based on the research-based assessment tools that we're using. I think it's important, if you look at the graph, you'll find that about 10%, those that were not able to get ready, come to us extremely well behind their peers in terms of development. And one of the things that we take this data very seriously, and because of this data, we're really doing what the president has asked us to do, to shift a lot of our services to early Head Start. So also, there's a handout that I asked to have available to you, which explains a little bit more about early Head Start, which is kind of a program that you don't hear about as much, and particularly early Head Start home visiting. We serve about 2,500 families in early Head Start home visiting, and these really create respectful relationships with families to improve birth outcomes, to help families understand how to enhance their child's development, and how to promote families' healthy functioning. So across Minnesota, you're going to be hearing that early Head Start is expanding, and we hope to have early Head Start in all of our service areas very soon. On October 1st, we did a count of the children that were on our waiting list, and that was just after we filled all our classrooms and made sure all our caseloads were full, and we had 3,800 income-eligible children on our waiting list. Research tells us these are children that can't afford to wait. These are children without early childhood services will just end up in our achievement gap. So we're here to tell you that we will be coming forward to the committee to request additional funding to expand our services, particularly early Head Start, and to be able to get more children mobilized off our waiting list. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Keller. I appreciate it. And I know we were pushing you a little bit on the time, so I apologize. Right. Any specific questions? Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So to the testifier, based on the data that you've given for home visits, what is your follow-up process? 5 years down the road, do you check to see if what you were doing with the families and with the children has paid off, whether it's in the school setting or the non-school setting?
Ms. Kelly.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. We have the opportunity with Early Head Start to be with families for 3 years. So actually, we can even begin at pregnancy and follow a child till three. But we don't have much opportunity, unless they come continue in Head Start, to know what happens to those families after. But you maybe have heard of the Head Start Impact Study, which I hope we don't have to go over today. But there also is a very important Early Head Start Impact Study that followed longitudinally early Head Start children and found great impacts in terms of outcomes long in after they left Head Start. A recent study right now just came out, I think it was about in October, that also showed that early Head Start reduced child protection calls, so it actually reduced physical abuse and sexual abuse for kids who had been in an early Head Start. So there's some really solid impacts for early Head Start, but unfortunately we aren't able to look at them when, you know, we're not tracking every individual child into school.
Representative Erickson?
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. All right. Well, thank you, Ms. Kelly. I very much appreciate you being here and traveling all the way from Duluth. We do appreciate it. Ms. Potter, Monica Potter, Minnesota Association of Family and Early Education. And members, there is a information being passed out pursuant to one of the questions that was asked. So the research short subject on child care assistance is being passed out for all of your information. All right, please go ahead and introduce yourself and present your testimony.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Dr. Monica Potter. I'm the program director of Robbinsdale Area Schools Early Childhood Programming, and I'm president of MNAFI, the Minnesota Association for Family and Early Education. At Robbinsdale Area Schools, early childhood includes ECFE, school readiness, preschool, family literacy, and screening. Our philosophy in all of early childhood that it always needs to include parent education. So we have parent education to support families weekly, on evenings, Saturdays, and we do home visits. Robbinsdale Area Schools Early childhood programming includes about 1,000 families. 50% of our families are free and reduced. About 40% of our families are families of color. About 30% of our families are English language learner. We have all 4-star rated programs, and we have 4 Pathway 1 scholarships, and we have only 27 Pathway 2 scholarships of all 1,000 families that we serve. I'd like to personally thank you for your interest, support, understanding the importance of early learning, and the importance of building a strong foundation in the brain to support a lifetime of successful learning. When you think of early learning, birth to age 5, you may think of home settings, child care centers, or educational school settings, such as preschool, ECFE, or Head Start. But I ask you, does parent education also come to mind? When economists talk about success in preschool for low-income families, such as the Perry Preschool in Michigan, did you know that those families, to increase their success, had parent education every week? They had a home visit to support their growth and learning. And when you think about parent education, it includes strengthening relationships, communication skills, how the brain develops and learns, positive guidance strategies, the importance of literacy, developing executive function, math, cognitive, and physical development. In addition, parent education programs in ECFE are all about building relationships in the community to support families, providing research-based information, skill building, and community support. This is critical for children's life success, as you know, and we appreciate your support. When you hear the terms parent involvement, parent engagement, that's different than parent education. All of these aspects continue or increase children's success in early childhood. Just recently, Dr. James Heckman, the economist from the University of Chicago, presented on December 10th at the White House Summit on Early Education. Dr. Heckman states that societies and the programs launched by today's initiatives should recognize that good parenting is paramount to life success. Without doubt, the family is the greatest contributor to the success of children and to upward social and economic mobility. And without doubt, in many quarters of our society, the American family, as we all know, is under great stress. Parents, the amount and way that parents interact with their children, the amount of time they spend with them, and the resources they have to provide intellectual and social stimulation greatly affect their children's potential for leading flourishing lives. The evidence shows dramatic differences in the achievement test scores and in social and character skills across children from different economic and social groups. Children of college-educated mothers achieve at a far higher rate than children whose mothers have a high school degree or less. These gaps emerge long before children enter kindergarten. When we're thinking about the gaps and the ways to break down the gaps, I urge you to always be thinking about parent education. Now, I sent around a study in ECFE on the 2012 evaluation measuring the impact of parent education, and 96% of parents reported that participating in ECFE improved their parenting. Also, on the back side of the report, you'll see that every area of child development and parent growth was significant and had positive changes. In addition,
and Ms. Better, I'm going to ask you, I'm sorry to wrap up, I've already got a couple of questions for you. So.
Okay. I just like to state that there were last year in legislation a couple statute changes for ECFE. Now it is every ECFE program is required to do an outreach to find most families in need, not only child need but parent need, such as military families deployed, any kind of stressor in families, and use this information to develop intentional programming. And there's also a new statute which involves ECFE programs where it's birth to third grade alignment, where parent educators can go into the elementary schools, and we've adopted these pieces in Robbinsdale area schools. Thank you. I tried to talk as fast as I could.
I'm sorry. You did a good job. Representative Mullery, you had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm a huge advocate of the early childhood going into the parent visiting and actually teaching, watching and making sure that they understand the brain development and how to actually, you can't lecture it. You have to watch the parent and correct them. But in fact, I was just at the White House with Libby Smith, but she's from DHS, and that's what I was wondering. Do you do this through education funding? I know we have in DHS here also, and in the federal, we have the visiting parent program, which was initially the visiting nurse, mm-hmm. or not visiting nurse, but it's an expanded program to teach brain development through a companion with the nurse. It's not very expanded here, but are you using education funds to do that same thing?
Yes, we're using ECFD funding. Oops, I'm sorry, Madam Chair and Representative Mullery. We're using ECFD funding to do home visiting.
Madam Mullery.
Thank you.
All right. No questions? All right. Ms. Potter, thank you very much. We appreciate you being here.
Thank you. I appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
All right. Now, Tom Holton, Mr. Holton with Bloomington Richfield Schools, representing the Minnesota Community Education Association. And after Mr. Holton, just so you're ready, Sandy Persley with the Minnesota Licensed Family Child Care Association. All right. Welcome, Mr. Holton. Please go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and present your testimony. And if you could keep it to about 3 minutes, that would be great.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Tom Holton. I'm the Executive Director of Community Services, serving both Bloomington and Richfield schools, southwest suburbs. First of all, thank you for allowing me to be here. We all know that the research on high-quality early education and care services and what a great public investment and the return on the investment. We all know that parents and children need choices. All parents and families don't need the same thing, so there isn't a one-size-fit-all. Scholarship program is a good attempt to give parents choice to choose the service that they need to make their children and families successful. I'm going to spend my few minutes talking about school readiness in public schools. There are many good programs. Not enough time in 3 minutes to talk about all the things we do in schools, so I'm going to talk about school readiness. First of all, school readiness programs in public schools have a long track record in Minnesota, and some of the unique features are we already have a statewide delivery system. There are school districts all across the state of Minnesota, and as the department testified, almost every single school district in the state of Minnesota currently has a school readiness program serving its residents. The programs are designed locally to meet family and particular community needs. We integrate children with special needs, providing an inclusionary experience for students who have been screened and placed in early childhood special education. By statute, we prioritize our state spending on families in poverty, English language learners, and children with other developmental challenges. So we focus our efforts the way the statute requires. At the local level and across the state, we continue to see improvements in our models that align curriculum, assessments, standards, and instruction to the K-12 system. Much research about the linking of our early childhood, especially to our K-3 program. And positioned with the school systems, we're developing those models with the help of MDE and the research to improve the way we do that. We, too, believe that engaging families in all of our programming is an important component. The parent is the first and most important teacher, and so anything that we do involves supporting the parents and what they do with education at home. We offer high-quality instruction with highly trained teachers. I know in Bloomington and Richfield, all of our instructors are licensed teachers. Virtually all parent aware, as the state reported, even though we had a fast-track system to get parent aware four-star rated, If there was a five-star, most school districts would probably earn that fifth star because in many cases we exceed what the state requires in the parent aware. I'm proud to report that our greatest selling point for school readiness is to our parents, to our community, and the legislature. We are doing a better job in school readiness than we ever have of assuring that all kids, and especially those from families of that are at risk, socioeconomic and ELL parents, are making the grade to be ready for kindergarten. I know that we've been tracking that data in Bloomington for over 10 years now, and we are happy to report in the last 2 years we have exceeded the 90% ready mark for all of our students that are participating in our program. We continue to see improvements in literacy, numeracy skills, as well as those executive function skills that allow students to be successful when they start in their more formal education. Our greatest challenge continues to be capacity. Prior to last year, the additional $2 million in school readiness funding, the funding formula hadn't changed since 1991. And that's in the midst of our changing demographics, the higher needs that we're seeing across all of our communities across the state of Minnesota. I know there are all kinds of demands with the legislature. There's never enough money to go around. But we know that school readiness works. We have evidence that supports how children improve in their skills and getting ready for kindergarten. And we know that the national research says that that investment is a great public investment. And now with the world's best workforce legislation that requires all school districts to assure that all kindergarten students are ready for kindergarten, we hope that the legislature pays particular attention to see that they can direct as many resources as possible to support that requirement of school districts. And thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Holton. We appreciate it. Just one quick question for you on your enrollment in your school readiness program. What percentage of your children in there are free and reduced lunch or economically disadvantaged students?
We have many options for parents, including a wide range where the parent pays nearly the full fee, all the way up to, in Bloomington, an example, we have a program we call Kinder Prep for four-year-olds. We're serving about 350 students of our four-year-old population, and that's about 1,500 total. Of those 350 students, over 90% are free and reduced, over 90% are EL learners, and almost all are both.
And thank you. I know I toured your program a few years ago, and I'm recalling from memory, does the Bloomington School District provide supplemental funds from other sources to enhance your program?
We now are spending more school readiness dollars from outside the state funding than we are getting from our state funding. And that includes scholarships. Thank you very much. 90-some thousand dollars. We added a full section of our Kinder Prep last year due to our Pathway 2 scholarships. But our Fund 1 is cross-subsidizing this year about $500,000. I think our total allotment from our school readiness aid is about $300,000. So it gives you an idea. We've gone way beyond what the state is providing based on the results we're getting. And the district is seeing such a great return in school readiness of our students.
Thank you. Representative Mulry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Quickly, what ages do you serve and do all of the programs around the state serve all those ages?
The statute for school readiness requires the money to be spent on 3- and 4-year-olds. And that's prioritized, of course, by kids that have social economic needs and that those that have been assessed for needing additional support. So a high percentage of EL learners and those that go through the screening, which we also do, that identify learning needs or kids that have certain developmental delays that don't meet the threshold for special ed.
Representative Slocum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Hi, Tom. Thanks for being here today and presenting. And you talked about touring before. With so many new members, it might be nice. And this is a program that works so beautifully for both Richfield and Bloomington. It's a combined program, or many of the programs are. And it would be great to go out and tour.
Yes, it would. I will investigate that, Representative Slocum. I'd like to do that. So thank you. All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Holton. We appreciate your being here and your testimony today.
Thank you again.
Ms. Sandy Persley, Minnesota Licensed Family Child Care Association. Welcome. Am I pronouncing your last name correctly?
Oh, absolutely.
All right. Thank you. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Mm-hmm. I'm Sandy Persley, Interim Executive Director for Minnesota Licensed Family Child Care Association, or MLFCCA. The mission of Minnesota Licensed Family Child Care Association is to support licensed family child care providers in achieving the highest standards of care for children in Minnesota's diverse licensed family child care homes and communities through education, resources, services, and advocacy. I'll address five topics very briefly with follow-up at a later time for more detail as you wish. And early learning scholarships. MLFCCA supports expanding the use of early learning scholarships in non-parent-aware rated licensed family child care programs that implement a parent-aware, aligned, and state-approved curriculum and assessment tool, even those who have chosen not to participate in parent-aware. There are just under 10,000 licensed providers in Minnesota currently. There has been a drop of probably more than 15% in the last 3 to 4 years. As of January 2015, there are 599 rated licensed family child care programs in Parent Aware, with 417 currently in progress or in process of being rated. The benefits of expanding the use of early learning scholarships in non-rated programs, family child care programs with state-approved curriculum and assessment, is a significant increase in family choice and accessibility to licensed family child care programs that support school readiness through curriculum and assessment. A significant increase in family choice and accessibility, especially in greater Minnesota, where a limited number of programs have chosen to participate or, due to timing of the expansion of Parent Aware, may not have yet come into the process of being able to participate. Another benefit is recognition of licensed family child care programs that are currently supporting school readiness, children and families through one of many quality paths, parent aware, accreditation, and the like. Again, the mission of MLFCCA is to support licensed family child care providers to achieve the highest standards of care for children in Minnesota. Regarding Parent Aware, MLFCCA continues to support Parent Aware as one of many quality pathways available to parents and families. Based on feedback that we have received from members and providers statewide, MLFCCA is forming a committee of licensed family providers who have been rated or are currently in process of being rated. This committee's goal will be to identify ways to make Parent Aware an option for providers who are uniquely challenged with time. Many of you probably understand licensed family child care providers are doing direct care for 55 to 60 hours a week, and their documentation and trainings and paperwork come beyond that 55 to 60 hours a week. So that's why I say they are uniquely time challenged on pursuing Parent Aware at times. In addition to these strenuous hours, evenings and weekends are filled with the tasks I just mentioned. Achieving a 3 or 4 star rating creates an additional hardship for providers, especially for those with very young children themselves, and many who choose this profession do have young children, or for single parents. We know most of them are single mothers who are choosing this profession as well. MLFCCA is excited to continue working towards the development and support of a rating system that provides parents the ability to gauge the quality of prospective programs and also respects the challenges that are unique to family child care. CCAP tied to Parent Aware. MLFCCA does not support tying the voluntary Parent Aware rating system to child care assistance at this time. Currently, less than 7% of licensed family child care providers in Minnesota have been rated. In many areas of the state, family child care is the only option available. There are not enough rated programs at this point to meet the need of CCAP. In addition, Parent Aware is a voluntary rating system. In many areas, the majority of families are CCAP clients, and providers in these areas are faced with a decision that can be difficult in terms of their investment of time to seek Parent Aware or to close their business. Again, I referenced there's been a fairly dramatic decrease in licensed providers over the last several years. Low-income and at-risk families should not have their options further limited by tying CCAP to Parent Aware. Since parents could still use, as it relates to CCAP, unlicensed caregivers, and their licensed options might be limited, the number of children in unlicensed and unregulated care could increase. Priority funding for CCAP is a preference before early learning scholarships. MLFCCA supports prioritizing funding so that CCAP can be fully funded before there is an addition to early learning scholarships. We're all aware of the fact that there are thousands of families on the waiting list for CCAP. And CCAP currently allows access to the maximum number of child care programs or providers within their community that support individual family child care needs, particularly as it relates to evening, weekend, and overnight care. Universal preschool. MLFCCA opposes universal preschool. It's a movement in direct conflict with research that continues to amplify the importance of early childhood play-based learning environments, like family child care. That supports play-based environments support children's interests and natural curiosities with time to explore and experience learning at their individual pace and level of development. Universal preschool does not address the need to fund research that specifically cites what type of care children who are not prepared for kindergarten are coming from. Funding that would determine that source of these children who are greatest at risk would then allow additional funding to be appropriately targeted. Based on the current adult-to-child ratio, universal preschool will significantly impact the sustainability of an already vulnerable licensed family child care profession, as I mentioned, which has lost significant numbers. It will force a market change likely that could negatively impact and create a financial burden for families seeking care specifically for children birth to age 3. Family child care providers may be forced to raise rates, unable to maintain their business, and have sustainable operating income. So sorry, my mouth is so dry.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Persley, and I appreciate that. I know we're pushing everyone. Is any questions for Ms. Persley at the current time? Thank you very much for presenting your thoughts today. All right, so here's what I would like to propose. We've got a few folks left on the testifier list, and one of the witnesses from Children's Defense Fund indicated they could be here tomorrow. So I'm wondering if the representatives from Mini Minds and also Schools for Equity in Education could also be here tomorrow. Okay, and so what I would propose is that then we have three representatives from the Richardson Elementary School, and I hate to have you away from your school 2 days in a row waiting to present. So if the three of you would come down, we'll have you testify today. That will be the end of our testimony for today, but tomorrow morning or tomorrow afternoon when committee reconvenes, we will finish those other testifiers before we move to our other planned topic for the day tomorrow. So that's how we will move forward with this. So welcome to all of you, and I'm going to let you introduce yourselves for the record, and then just be mindful. I'm going to push the committee slightly late, which I promised lots of people I would not do, but today we just can't avoid it. So introduce yourselves. I'm going to say 5 minutes in total for you, and then we do have to wrap for today. So welcome.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for having us here today. My name is Pang Zhang, and I'm a teacher in North St. Paul. As a former kindergarten teacher, I can attest to how pre-K affected my teaching. Kindergartners proudly waved goodbye to their parents, and fewer tears were shed because friends were waiting for them. Routines took less time to teach because they already knew the school expectations. All of this resulted in more instruction time. They were ready to learn, and we reached them in developmentally appropriate ways. Ultimately, my entire class performed better, academically, socially, and emotionally. Kindergarten expectations were raised altogether with pre-K. Pre-K especially benefited students like Nathan, who came from a single-parent home with 4 children. Nathan entered as one of the lowest kindergartners and barely met the end-of-year expectations. Pre-K jump-started his learning. Without his pre-K experiences, he would have already been lagging behind his peers by the end of kindergarten. And 24 years ago, I also reaped the benefits of pre-K. My parents simply wanted us to have a fighting chance at survival, but the skills that once fed and protected them in their old country were no longer sufficient, so they entrusted us to the public school system. It's students like Nathan and myself who are grateful for the leverage that provided us with the opportunity to learn and grow in pre-K, because our parents alone and their love would not have been able to give us these opportunities. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Jenna Peters, and I'm the principal at Richardson Elementary School in North St. Paul. We are a Minnesota Celebration School, and I'm here to talk to you a little bit today about the impact that I see pre-K making on our students at Richardson. We all know the research behind early learning and that achievement gaps exist even as children enter kindergarten. And what we also know is that the lack of pre-K programs available to all students creates an opportunity gap. As families with students who can benefit most from an effective program are typically those who can least afford to pay for one. Our pre-K program has helped students come to kindergarten socially and emotionally ready to be in school. Students who are in our pre-K programs are rarely referred for behavior issues in kindergarten beyond, meaning they are spending more time in their classrooms learning. We're seeing similar trends academically among our pre-K students. Of the 71 students who have come through our pre-K program, only 4 are in intervention, which is only about 5%. If you compare that to the roughly 12% who are not in our pre-K program who are currently in intervention now. So in other words, kids who are not in our pre-K program are about 2.5 times more likely to be in intervention. Giving traditionally underserved students the opportunity to attend pre-K is positively impacting their success in kindergarten and beyond. We know that early school success is a strong predictor of later school success, and all students deserve this opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you.
And my name is Peter Mao. I'm the Supervisor of Educational Programs in District 622. And for reasons just stated, District 622 would like to offer preschool programming for more of its families. About 1,800 students we have reside in 622, ages 3 and 4, and we provide services to just under 350. That's less than 20%, and funding is a significant barrier to access to those services. Unfortunately, District 622 is not in a financial position to invest any more of its discretionary funds into pre-K programming. We already invest about $216,000 from federal Title I program to support pre-K. Over the last 10 years, we've cut more than $23 million from our general operating budget and face extensive budget cuts again this year. And at $900 per pupil, our operating referendum is about half of many surrounding districts, I believe about half of Bloomington schools, who you heard from earlier as well. And so we simply don't have the general fund dollars to put toward supplementing pre-K programming, nor do we have a levy that specifically funds pre-K, as I know at least one other district does. As you've heard, research demonstrates that high-quality pre-K can change the trajectory of lives for kids, especially those living in poverty. And our percentage of kids who qualify for free and reduced price meals grows annually and is currently over 50%. And without additional funding, many families living in District 622 will not have access to those gap-closing services. And that's even with the state funding for ECFE, school readiness, pathways, and other sources. And I just want to end on a personal note. As a former principal of a school that had a free pre-K program, one of the most difficult conversations that I ever had to have was with those families in need who applied for the program, and we simply didn't have the money for their child to attend, and knowing what that could mean for the future of that child. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Any questions for these witnesses? All right. I thank you very much, Ms. Zhang, Mr. Mao.
North St. Paul.
And, yes, they are. Did you ask where they were from?
North
St. Paul.
North St. Paul is 662.
622.
Thank you. So, all right. Thank you to the three of you. And, again, for those of you who are planning to testify today and we ran out of time, please plan to be first up tomorrow afternoon. And with that, I thank the committee for their indulgence in going over a little bit. We are adjourned.